Yeah, hi. Is the clerk there? Is the clerk?
Yes, Judge.
Just wanted to let you know that I'm here and I'll appear when you hit the gavel.
Perfect. I'll let the panel know. Thank you.
Great. Thanks.
this afternoon. Please be seated. We're here today for argument in Deere v. Ryan. Judge Gould is with us by video. Can you hear us, Judge Gould?
Yes, I can hear you, and good afternoon.
Thank you. You may proceed.
May it please the Court, Therese Day for the petitioner-appellant, Mr. Richard Jerf. With the Court's permission, I would like to focus on two claims today, the Eddings claim and the Martinez claim, and address the two cases brought to our attention by the Court, which we've discussed in our letter brief. I'm going to begin with the Eddings claim. At sentencing, Mr. Jerf presented compelling facts about his childhood and mental state that should have been considered by the Arizona Supreme Court. Mr. Jerf was raised by an alcoholic father who drank heavily every night, often passing out. His parents had minimal interaction with him as a small child and never expressed any kind of physical or verbal affection or love. Shortly after his parents divorced when Mr. Jerf was 6 years old, Mr. Jerf's mother relinquished custody of her children, and her relationship with them thereafter became almost non-existent. The effect of abandonment by his mother and absence of interaction by his father caused Mr. Jerf to withdraw even more into himself, and by the time he was in high school, his father described him as a loner. There was also evidence in the record at sentencing that Mr. Jerf had a closed head injury as a toddler, which was re-injured on more than one occasion.
So there was a great deal more mitigation evidence in a case like Apelt, where there was evidence of extreme violence and the like as part of his family history. And yet the court in that case determined that that any Lockett-Eddings error was harmless. So under Brecht, that didn't have a substantial or injurious effect. So why, even if we agree, assuming we agree with you that there was a Lockett-Edding error, which would cause us to review the that issue de novo and not give it a deference to the state court, can you address the Brecht question and why that error had a substantial and injurious effect, given the details of the crime? Why would it be mitigated, the type of evidence that you were giving, which is fairly ordinary or mild compared to Apelt, why would that be mitigating in this case and overwhelming aggravating factors?
Yes, Judge Ikuda. I just wanted to point out a couple more bits of mitigation that impacts his mitigation picture. And that is, after he was in custody, he was extremely depressed and attempted to commit suicide. While he was in custody, he was also seen at the Madison County Jail Psychiatric Unit on a number of occasions for suicidal thoughts and gestures. And in addition to that, defense counsel filed two reports with the court by defense experts at the time of sentencing. While they didn't present these experts at sentencing, these two reports were in the record, and the Arizona Supreme Court reviewed them when considering this claim on independent review. In the first report, Dr. McMahon, in January of 1996, found that his testing revealed that someone who had difficulty processing information and holding information in immediate memory, making it difficult to solve problems and make decisions, which could be indicative of a learning disability or neuropsychological dysfunction. The second report by Dr. Mark Walter followed up with further testing later in January of 1996 and found that Mr. Jerf may have had a right temporal disturbance, which could have profound effects on behavior and volitional awareness and control.
Which case, either Ninth Circuit or Supreme Court case, do you think is most similar to this in the sense of aggravating circumstances and the mitigating evidence that you've recounted? Which case would you have us look at that would support saying that the Lockett-Edding errors had a substantial injurious effect?
Well, I can't point to a recent case in the Ninth Circuit that I'm aware of. I've reviewed a lot of these cases, as have you, and I know we've been here before on these cases. I just think that you really cannot underplay the effect that this kind of childhood has on a developing brain. And, in fact, Mr. Jerf had two reports in the record that discussed the fact that there was something going on. There was brain dysfunction resulting from the childhood that he had. What I do have is the cases that we know, the Supreme Court cases. In Eddings, the U.S. Supreme Court found that a dysfunctional family background combined with emotional disturbance is particularly relevant. In Smith v. Texas, the Supreme Court found that the failure to consider a father's drug addiction was unconstitutional. And in Penry v. Lena, the Supreme Court found that evidence of a troubled family background and emotional and mental problems may lessen a defendant's moral culpability. So while I can't point to a case that's exactly like Mr. Jerf's, we do have these Supreme Court cases. And I think that also it's important to consider that even when the facts of the crime are egregious, a life sentence may be given. In Douglas v. Woodford, this court noted that the gruesome nature of the killing did not necessarily mean that the death penalty was unavoidable.
We have to determine that if the mitigating evidence had been considered, it would outweigh the aggravating factors. And I'm wondering what case support you have, because the facts of the crime are, as you point out, egregious, they're very horrifying, and the facts of mitigation are not as substantial as in some of our other cases, even in cases like Apel where we found that it wasn't mitigating.
Well, as I said, there are two Ninth Circuit cases where the facts were extremely egregious, Douglas v. Woodford and Smith v. Stewart. And in both of those cases, this court found that the horrific nature of the crimes does not cause us to find an absence of prejudice. And I also feel
on that point, in most of these cases, you know, where we have found prejudice, for example, in McKinney, it's quite clear the sentencing judge was very troubled, and the evidence seems to be overwhelming on the prejudice side. So I'd be interested in your thought about how we look and weigh this when we have one of the sisters saying, well, we actually had a father who was good and loving. We have one sister says, you know, he was a good provider. Yes, this gentleman is a loner. And yet when you look at the evidence, it doesn't seem to tip in any overwhelming way. There's a lot of evidence that, if you will, kind of neutralizes itself. How do we view that?
Well, again, I think that you just cannot downplay the effect of his childhood, having an alcoholic father who had no interaction with him whatsoever. He worked, he provided for the family, he came home and cooked dinner, and that was it. Mr. Jerf ate in his bedroom by himself every single day from the time he was at least 6 years old. He had no contact. His parents were not involved with him in any way, shape, or form. They didn't play with him. They didn't help him with homework. They weren't involved in school. And I think that the two reports that are in the record indicate that this had an impact on his brain. There was brain dysfunction.
The statements he made to reporters to the effect that he can't blame his home life and he doesn't really put emotional problems as the cause for this? Is any of that taken into account?
I think that, and granted, this is an Eddings claim, and we're looking at what was presented in state court. There are also pretty serious problems with the way the case was mitigated. We are arguing that there was enough, that the Arizona Supreme Court should have considered this evidence. However, trial counsel, you know, did very minimal investigation in the case, and in fact, they didn't begin their mitigation case until very late. They also never obtained any kind of background records that you would normally see for mitigation. There were no medical records, no mental health records, no school records,
And what would those have shown? Now that you have them, the mitigation that I saw in the additional mitigation that I saw in the briefing was not very extensive.
Well, I think that the records are essential to any kind of expert report, for example. And Dr. Potts, who this after Mr. Jerf had waived counsel, the state, not defense counsel, but the state was concerned about his reason for doing that because it seemed illogical. And so they requested a competency hearing, and Dr. Potts was tasked with that. The court ordered all the parties to provide all sorts of records, you know, mental health records, background information, because any time a mental health evaluation is done, it requires context of background. You can't just test and come up with conclusions that are accurate. You have to have a full picture of what's going on with that person based on their family background. And in this case, Dr. Potts wrote to the court prior to submitting that report saying, the court has ordered defense counsel to meet with me and to provide me records, and I've received nothing to date and cannot do this evaluation without those records. In addition, much later in the case at sentencing, Mark Walter, the report that's in the record and the report that was provided to the prosecution, who was doing a neuropsychological evaluation of Mr. Jerf, said that I've requested school records, which are essential for this evaluation, and to date I have not received any of them.
And if he had had the school records, how would that have made a difference?
I think, well, those aren't in the record, Judge Ikuda, but generally these provide context for what is going on.
So you didn't make a proffer, having reviewed the in any of the prior proceedings, there wasn't a proffer of what the records would have said that would have made a difference?
Not the records specifically, Judge Ikuda, but during habeas proceedings, counsel attempted to expand the record and seek discovery, and the district court refused that. We weren't allowed to.
Now know the Supreme Court has said that you can't do that unless you're reviewing it de novo. So
okay.
He had a diploma, but he did drop out of high school, correct?
He did, and having a higher IQ, I mean, it wasn't, you know, his IQ was not so high, but it was a high IQ. Having a high IQ does not mean that there aren't underlying brain dysfunction or underlying mental illnesses. There are many schizophrenics, for example, who have genius-level IQs. So
that would really be going, I'm saying, to the school records. Either school records would either tell you...
Oh, you're asking what you might find in school records, for example.
They would tell you grades, and they might tell you behavioral, depending on the records.
Correct, or absences. Sometimes there's also references in there, and Dr. McMahon had made a reference that there may be a learning disability. There could have been references in the records about learning disabilities. Now, sometimes school records don't accurately record that, and you have to do more digging in your investigation to find out how they're coding grades. But it could have revealed things about learning disabilities. It could have revealed things about, you know, the fact that his father never came to teacher-student conferences or never engaged in any kind of activity with the school. I mean, we just don't know because that's not part of the record.
But we do
here.
Know that. I mean, that's the gist of the record, is that the parents were distant from him.
Correct.
So that would just be, in some ways, duplicative or similar in nature, correct?
I understand what you're saying, Judge McKeown, and I do understand what you're saying, Judge Ikuda, also. I mean, this isn't a case where we see extreme violence. We don't see extreme beatings and deprivation, but I don't think that you have to have that mm-hmm. to find that there's prejudice. I feel that when you have, you know, this kind of background and an effect on a child, and the crimes themselves cried out for an explanation, and no explanation was given, you know,
that,
really.
That's, I think, the difficult situation we're in, that you've appropriately identified, where here we have a number of aggravating factors and we have a very horrific crime in terms of the prompting for it and that sort of thing, and then we're left, of course, to try to factor in the abstract how this would have affected things. One of the ways we do that is Judge Ikuda started down the road of, well, is it more like Apfeld? Is it, you know, is it like Greenway? Is it like this? So what we're trying to do, and hoping that you'll assist us with, is, well, where does that fit in our cases? Because each one of these, of course, is different. Each one of these individuals that we are asked to review has a very different history, and most of them are not pretty histories, of course. But in some cases we find no prejudice, and in others we find prejudice. So I think it'll be helpful to the court if you can say, well, really this tilts to prejudice. Why?
Well, I feel, I mean, we, during the district court proceedings, we attempted to introduce a report from Dr. Gurr, who's a neuropsychiatrist. And his findings were that he also saw brain dysfunction that was consistent with what is often seen in bright people with schizophrenia. However, we were prevented from developing that evidence. And, you know, and I think that's the key here. I mean, and granted, we're looking at just what was in the record. But, you know, what we have is we have these Supreme Court cases that talk about this kind of evidence being compelling. We have Douglas v. Woodford and Smith v. Stewart, which were, you know, crimes that were quite egregious. And even in those cases, you know, this court said that. That doesn't mean that there's an absence of prejudice. So I feel like, you know, I think that you have to think outside the box and not think in terms of, well, there always must be this extreme deprivation and there must always be this extreme violence that we see, that we saw in McKinney or Headland. That's not required. You're not required to see that to find prejudice. We feel that there's enough on this record to demonstrate prejudice. And that's, you know, that's where we are.
Counsel, if I could interject, just help me on the facts here. Was this penalty phase tried to the judge or a jury at this stage?
It was tried to a judge, Judge Gould.
Okay, so in that context, you know, we have Supreme Court precedents telling us that when we look at prejudice, at least in the jury context, we can ask if there's a reasonable probability that the extra mitigation evidence would have caused one juror to change their mind. They needed a unanimity. How do we apply that kind of standard in the context of a judge determination?
Thank you for that question, Judge Gold. And I think, Judge, I could even raise this before that. You know, if it's tried by a jury and they're given instructions, then there might be more confusion there. I think in this case, what we have is that there was this evidence presented to the judge. And the judge, because of the Arizona state law at the time, the judge was prevented from considering this evidence. And, you know, that's what we're relying on. I mean, this was evidence that should have been considered. It was never considered. It was never considered by the sentencing court. It was never.
And the question for us is, had the court applied the correct law and knew that he could consider the mitigation, notwithstanding the lack of a causal nexus, would it have made a difference? That's the issue before us that we're trying to get your help on. And why would it have made a difference? In light of what he did consider and the aggravating circumstances?
Well, I think I have said all that I can say on that. Judge Ikuda, I wish I could say more. I feel that this is what we have. We have evidence of brain dysfunction as a result of his childhood that could have impacted his actions at the time of the crime, could have explained what happened at the time of the crime, and instead, you know, the courts considered nothing.
So the psychiatric information that was not before the court, but that was because, am I right, that was because the lawyer chose not to present it?
That's correct.
And that's because the evidence, or at least one of the doctors, thought that he was dangerous. There was evidence of psychopathic personality as opposed to schizophrenia. So so that evidence had been gathered but not presented to the judge.
That was not presented. That's correct, Your Honor. And this is exactly
so
where...
So that's not the mitigation evidence that wasn't considered. That was purposely not put into the record.
That's correct. And we would say as to that, because trial counsel did no mitigation investigation and gave no records, no background to these experts... the experts did not actually have enough to make an accurate assessment about what was going on with JERF. There's no question that all of the experts saw the same thing. They all saw this brain dysfunction, but without the context of understanding anything about the family background, without any kind of record supporting, you know, his head injury, no hospital records, no mental health records, nothing from even the jail psychiatric records, there was no context for their conclusions.
And that's a different issue, correct? I mean, the question, the Eddings-Lockett error goes to what did the judge consider?
That's
what I'm talking about. What other evidence might have been better developed in the record had the attorney done a better job? So a slightly different and ineffective assistance, perhaps.
But you had mentioned a report that the judge hadn't seen or considered, and that's why I was addressing that, Judge Ikuda.
Right.
That was something that was put into the record.
You were talking about Dr. Gurr and that information, which relates to if the attorney had done a better job, as opposed to how would it have been different if the judge had considered the mitigation evidence?
Actually, I was referring to your reference to the McMahon report that was admitted during PCR that was never before the court. You had talked about the findings in that second report of Dr. McMahon. That was not before the court. That's why I offered that explanation.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. If there's no more questions,
does the question sort of boil down to whether there's a reasonable probability that the sentencing judge would have made a different decision if given all the evidence that was improperly excluded under the causal nexus test, and if given all the evidence that, you know, reasonably diligent counsel should have developed?
Are we talking about what counsel should have developed, Judge Gould? Is that what you want to hear about?
Do we have to take both those groups of evidence, everything counsel should have developed but didn't develop, and everything counsel did develop that the court excluded under the causal nexus test?
To be honest, go ahead, Judge Gould. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Do we take both those categories of evidence and say, would it have made a reasonable probability of making a difference with the judge that he had everything?
Well, I think that had the judge properly considered the evidence, then there is a reasonable probability that there, you know, could have been a different result. We believe that. I'm not sure I've completely sold this court on that argument. But, you know, in fact, you know, even if more had been introduced into the record, given the state of the law at the time in Arizona and the actual language of the sentencing court and the actual language of the Arizona Supreme Court, and, of course, on habeas, we review the last reasoned decision, so we're looking at what the Arizona Supreme Court did. But to be honest, if more had been introduced, they were still applying the causal nexus to all of his mitigating evidence related to his dysfunctional childhood and his mental health issues. So I don't know that the result would have been different, to be honest, because they were applying this causal nexus inappropriately.
I know you wanted to address Martinez, and I also know you probably want to save some time for rebuttals.
I would. Thank you so much, Judge McKeown. I'm going to talk a little bit about Martinez right now. We all know the Martinez standard, so I'm going to skip over that and just talk about what happened in this case, if that's okay with the court. Okay, thank you. In Mr. Jerf's case, the district court not only made factual errors in reviewing the evidence, but also appears to have turned the Martinez standard on its head by requiring Mr. Jerf to demonstrate that he fully satisfied Strickland on the merits of his claim before it could determine whether there was cause for default pursuant to Martinez. While this court found that for purposes of Martinez remand, Mr. Jerf's claims were substantial, so when it sent it back to the court, it said, for purposes of remand, we find the claim substantial. The district court found that substantiality had not actually been demonstrated, and therefore, to demonstrate substantiality, it had to examine the merits of the underlying IAC claim before excusing the procedural default. So it did the opposite of what is supposed to be done in Martinez
places. I was sort of curious about the argument, because it seems that the merits of the ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim is, if the court did it correctly, is before us de novo. And if you won on the Martinez claim, that's exactly what we would be looking at de novo. So it wasn't clear to me. I suddenly realized, what difference does it make? Because here we are looking at ineffective assistance of Vaughn and Simpson at trial, de novo without AEDPA deference. So does it really matter?
Well, we think it matters.
Well,
I sort of thought maybe it was in the end to your advantage, but maybe you can dissuade me on that.
I think it might be helpful to talk about the case of Rodney v. Filson. And I think that Rodney recognized that different panels of this circuit, as well as the en banc plurality and Dietrich, have applied a different interpretation of what Martinez meant and what Martinez required when sending a case back and determining whether there was cause for default of an ineffective assistance of trial counsel claim during post-conviction proceedings. And in Rodney, the court noted that Dietrich concluded that a petitioner seeking cause for default under Martinez need not make an additional showing of prejudice over and above the requisite showing of substantiality. And so under Dietrich, you basically say PCR counsel should have raised this claim, they were deficient for not doing so, and the only prejudice you need to establish under Dietrich is that the claim was substantial, which means the claim has some merit.
So that was what Judge Fletcher said in Dietrich, but he didn't get a majority of the votes. And so we're now bound by Claiborne, which says for cause and prejudice, the prejudice just has to be a substantial claim. But for cause, you have to show ineffective assistance of counsel, of PCR counsel, under Strickland, which has two prongs, deficiency and prejudice. And we're bound by Claiborne, and I think Filson applied the same test.
Well, I think that we're not bound by Claiborne because it wasn't en banc. I think that many panels have applied Claiborne since Claiborne and have said that you have that additional level of prejudice. But in Rodney v. Filson, the court said that they're distinguishing these two claims, and in the case of a situation where someone has no counsel versus ineffective counsel, then in fact Dietrich applies, and that person need only establish deficient performance of PCR counsel and that the claim had some merit. And I think that this is showing us that the standard in this circuit is not settled, that Claiborne is not settled. And I think that there's good reason for not applying that extra level of prejudice because, granted, Martinez did say ineffective assistance of PCR counsel, and in order, and then also as the prejudice part, it said that the claim must have some merit. But in Rodney, Rodney's really clear that in distinguishing the standards and saying that in some cases where there's no counsel, then Dietrich applies. And our argument is that there's no reason for distinguishing between no counsel and ineffective counsel because ineffective counsel under, you know, violating the Sixth Amendment is the same as having no counsel. So now we have yet another panel, the panel of Rodney v. Filson, saying that Dietrich does apply in some circumstances. It's also important to note that Martinez itself did not distinguish between whether someone had no counsel or had ineffective counsel. And so we believe that the Dietrich, which is also the Dickens approach, is the proper approach for the standard.
And where do you get – you started out in a way, and I was trying to follow all your –
I'm sorry.
No, but it was helpful. You started out in a way to say, you know, the court has not been consistent. And then Judge Acuda, of course, mentions – what part of Dietrich is or is not controlling, and then you started to go through these various cases. Is your final conclusion that we shouldn't apply Claiborne, that the court is inconsistent, but that we should apply Dietrich?
Well, I think...
in other words, you're weaving, understandably, between and among various cases. But when you first started out and said we haven't been consistent, then that would make me think, well, we don't really have the choice to pick and choose which of those to pick.
This panel, you mean?
Yes.
Yes. Well, we would encourage you to follow Dietrich because that is the best approach. And it tracks more closely to what Martinez said, because if you're adding that additional level of prejudice that Claiborne discusses, then what do you do with the substantiality in Martinez? What do you do with the fact that the Supreme Court has said this underlying IAC claim need only be substantial, which means it need only have some merit? How can you then say that you must just positively prove that as part of the same standard? And I see I'm really low on time and would like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Ginger Jarvis for the State of Arizona. Judge Ikuda, I think you hit the nail on the head when you started out by asking whether or not anything here is substantial and injurious effect on the verdict. And I think that none of these issues is merit, has merit, but even if they did, there is no substantial and injurious effect on the verdict given.
Could you speak up just a little because the room is echoing? Thank you.
Given the horrendous crimes and aggravation in this case. Do you have a preference on starting with Eddings or with
it's
Martinez?
It's your choice. It's your argument.
Regarding the Eddings claim, I think that it is first important to remember that whether that an Eddings challenge to the trial court's sentencing and sentence was, in fact, raised on direct appeal, which was then decided by the Arizona Court of Appeals, or Arizona Supreme Court, excuse me. And that in itself is a factual finding due double deference under AEDPA. And then whether or not there was McKinney error, which is alleged Eddings error in the Arizona Supreme Court's independent review, is a separate and discrete claim.
I know you argued McKinney error, but I couldn't understand what that meant. The petitioner argues that there was a Lockett and Eddings error, and in McKinney, the court said, the en banc court said by name, that error is in JERF. It's in the Arizona Supreme Court's decision in JERF. So I think we're bound by that. Do you disagree?
I do disagree. Well, first of all, McKinney doesn't moot this case. You have to decide this case on the facts and circumstances in the individual case. So what another court said about it in another case is really irrelevant to this decision. Moreover, JERF was also cited, and I believe it was Stokely, in a footnote, citing it as a case that exhibited the Arizona Supreme Court was, in fact, doing it correctly. So that alone brings us right close to APEL, which was mentioned before, where at the best you can say is that reasonable minds can differ and that there would be no change in the result, even if there were more consideration of what was already considered. But again, McKinney error happens in the Arizona Supreme Court's independent review, and in order to challenge the independent review, there must have been a motion for reconsideration in the Arizona Supreme Court, which there wasn't after the opinion was issued, which of course makes it defaulted for federal review. But the challenge to the trial court's analysis under Eddings was preserved on direct appeal, and that is itself a finding by the Arizona Supreme Court, which is due double deference then by this court. And regardless, there was no error. Both the trial court and the Arizona Supreme Court specifically looked at the difficult family background evidence that was presented, and found it weak and not sufficiently substantial to call for leniency, which is, of course, the ultimate question that the sentencer is looking at.
Of course, what we mean by that has not been played out too much in the Sprites case, the more recent case. That test was framed as central to the plea for leniency, and it does seem that the evidence presented from Mr. Pierce with respect to his family was actually his central focus on his plea for leniency. So what do we do with that language that comes out of Sprites?
I think Sprites is factually distinguishable from the instant case because I disagree with the majority panel there, obviously, and even on how they got to review it because it was also procedurally defaulted and they were looking at a PCR court ruling. But in any event, the way that they perceived the difficult family background as being central to what somehow fed into to why he then had substance abuse and other issues and mental health issues, none of which is here. I mean, I think that the difficult family background was weak, but that there wasn't much mitigation to go forward here with in any event, because the defendant himself said several times, both in the pre-sentence report and to Dr. McMahon and to two or three different reporters, that his family background was uneventful. He had an uneventful childhood apart from his parents' divorce, and that you can't blame his family for what he did. That he did what he did, and it wasn't their fault. So it just simply was weak. even if it was central, it was weak. And that is what the trial court assessed, and that is what the Arizona Supreme Court reviewed and also assessed. So I think in comparison, if you're asking, answering the question you asked previously about where in the spectrum of these cases that it falls, the mitigation is weaker and the aggravation is stronger than almost any other case, and even in the other cases where this court has found no Eddings error. In Lopez, the 2007 Lopez, or in 2011 Lopez, or in Towery, or in Mann, or in Apelt, or Henry, or Stokely, or Greenway, all the mitigation is weaker and the aggravation is stronger. So that is why the district court correctly found that the Arizona Supreme Court properly applied, or their decision was a reasonable application of controlling Supreme Court case law. Does that help? Do you have any other Eddings questions?
I don't have any more. Do you have any other Eddings questions?
No.
Do you want to move on to Martinez?
All right. The Martinez, well, obviously, I think Claiborne applies. You still have to show actual prejudice. And Judge Ikuda, you explained it so beautifully, and it's very convoluted, but a Martinez claims IAC of PCR counsel. So to show PCR counsel was ineffective, you have to apply the Strickland standard, which has two prongs, deficient performance and prejudice. And under either prong, you're going to look at the merits of the underlying claim.
So can we turn to that question? And that was something that opposing counsel didn't answer, because we're here looking at ineffective assistance of trial counsel without AEDPA deference, which we look at in order to, in my view, in order to do the Martinez analysis, or if it turned out that PCR counsel was ineffective, then we would just get to look at the ineffective assistance of trial counsel de novo without AEDPA review. So either way, we're looking at that. So the claim that's made by opposing counsel is that Vaughn and Simpson were ineffective during this 15-month pretrial period. And in their brief, they cite all sorts of examples based on the status conferences and the like as to why they were ineffective. Can you explain why they were not, in your view?
Yes. Thank you for that question. There were a number of status conferences because under the criminal rules at the time, a firm trial date could only be extended for 30 days. So every 30 days they were in court, and every 30 days the trial judge was going over with defense lawyers and with the prosecutor how discovery was proceeding and how interviews were going. There were a number of interviews, and the trial court also specifically says over and over how well they're doing. They know that they're proceeding properly. I believe one of the defense lawyers at one point said, "This has been going as smoothly as I've experienced in my 21 years." There was a lot of evidence, as you can imagine, from the house and from what happened in that house. There were fingerprint experts because the defendant's fingerprints were found on the tape that bound the victims there, and also on a tin inside Rochelle's bedroom where she was raped and murdered. There was also ballistics experts because the bullets in the house matched the defendant's gun. There was also experts about the knife that he brought to the house that was through the father's arm and into his chest, which was broken off. Fingerprints matched. His fingerprints were on the sheath, and it also matched a set of knives he had at his house.
So the argument is that the attorneys delayed key interviews. They were inadequate in attempting to get discovery. Mr. Jerf's main complaint was they didn't communicate with him sufficiently. They didn't visit him sufficiently. And there was lengthy periods of lack of communication.
All of that is, with the exception of visits, I think, is belied by the record. And even the visits, they did visit. They just didn't visit as often as Mr. Jerf requested or wanted or wished. He, in fact, even included in one of his letters to the judge or one of his motions a prison visit log that shows both counsel visiting at different times and their investigator, Mr. Hanratty, visiting. So they were working it up. There were delays involved because there was an ongoing DNA issue that was being litigated in a consolidated 10 cases. So,
how was that relevant to Mr. Jerf's case?
It had to do with a court of appeals decision. I think this was sort of at the burgeoning point of DNA evidence moving from just sort of blood type to more specific, population reduction kind of evidence. In fact, there was even one of those evidence. I think there was what did they call it? It was not a geneticist, but like a genealogist kind of expert that was going to attack that kind of DNA evidence that the defense lawyers had been interviewing. And in fact, they also had three different mitigation experts, mental health experts, that were consulted. Although, see, at the time, remember, too, that this is pre-Ring. So at the time, there would be a guilt verdict, and then often 18 months before there was a sentencing, aggravation, mitigation, or a pre-sentencing hearing. So this case proceeded a little differently because all of a sudden Mr. Drift decided to plead, which was, by the way, about 6 months after he decided to take over his own defense. So, I mean, there simply is no evidence that these lawyers, who were very experienced lawyers and very involved, and in fact, even as advisory counsel, they stayed involved and were ready to take over and try the case at any time should the defendant have decided to revoke his waiver of counsel. And the trial court and the prosecutor put in the record how much they had been doing and how involved they had been. And the trial court specifically asked Mr. Jerf, do you agree? And he said yes. So he knew how much work they were doing. He just wanted to take over. So that is all relevant to deciding whether or not PCR counsel was ineffective for raising other claims and not this claim, which clearly shows that she was not.
The opposing counsel also raises other issues about PCR counsel and her deficiency as being deficient due to mental impairments, I believe was one of the claims.
And I believe that they were in particular, as the district court noted, in relation to other cases. But regardless, I mean, a personal attack like that on her personally is not the Strickland standard, because the Strickland standard is objective for that very reason, that it matters what you do. Okay, she raised several claims in a PCR, and she didn't raise other claims. Was that reasonable or was it not? Did it fall below the standard of a reasonable attorney? And it did not. So those are irrelevant. And
so you're saying no matter how impaired an attorney might be, if they accidentally did a job that would somehow meet the Strickland standard, then it doesn't matter?
Well, I think that the kind of impairment you're talking about would show in the record and would have been resolved long before this. It certainly wouldn't be a case where there wasn't any at all indication in the record that she was so impaired that she was not able to perform the functions of an attorney, because she did, in fact, do that.
Is the question counsel, I have a question for you. What is the precise standard for us to use in evaluating Strickland prejudice in a case where the penalty decision is made by a judge rather than a jury?
What is the Strickland standard?
Right.
Well, the prejudice is going to be much more difficult to show with a judge than with a jury, because a judge, for a lot of reasons, you know what the judge considered because you have a special verdict, whereas with a jury, you just have a verdict. So the judge shows what he looked at, why he looked at it, how he weighed it. So I think that to the extent that there is a difference, there's a much greater, a bigger hurdle to show Brecht anyway in this circumstance, to show that there would be a substantial injurious effect, given the record in this case and given what we know the trial court looked at.
Okay, thank you.
Your question? Okay. Does the court have any other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Then I would just urge the court to affirm, because there really is no substantial or injurious effect in this case. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd just like to point out a couple things in the 1 minute that I have left. The AG is representing that things were going swimmingly during the pretrial period of this case as far as trial counsel's investigation, and that they were reporting to the court every month and everyone was saying how great things were. And I don't have much time, but I will say this, that in August of 1994, although defense counsel had been appointed to the case for close to 1 year, all the parties, including the judge, the prosecutor, and counsel themselves, acknowledged that defense was not ready for trial. Vaughn told the trial court that a trial date in September was not realistic. He explained that he needed a continuance because multiple things needed to be done. The prosecutor noted the same, saying there's a tremendous amount of evidence that still needs to be reviewed by the defense.
Is that unusual in a capital case?
I think it was, no, well, yes, I think it is unusual, and I think part of the reason, and I think the court clearly understands this, Judge Ikuda, by your statements, which we laid out in our brief. I mean, trial counsel was in court on many other cases. Trial counsel was out with illnesses. Trial counsel was doing a lot of other things other than working on this case, and so it is unusual, because normally in a capital case with counsel who's effective, their investigation for both phases of the case begin early on, and it's extensive because it needs to be extensive in a capital case. And just one quick thing about the state and the Eddings claim. The state argued in the state court and in federal court that a causal nexus was required to be demonstrated in order for the courts to consider non-statutory mitigating evidence. They put that forth in their direct appeal, and they argued that in habeas proceedings. And now, and they actually prevailed on those arguments. The Arizona Supreme Court disregarded Jerf's mitigating evidence and affirmed his death sentence, and the federal court ruled that the state court's use of this causal nexus did not violate the Constitution. So they won. And now they're reversing their position in an effort to win again. And now they're saying that the state court never did that, when in fact they argued below that they had. We feel that this is impermissible and that judicial estoppel prevents them from relying on an argument that's exactly the opposite of what they've raised below. And thank you. I apologize for going over.
No, not a problem at all. I want to thank both counsel for your argument and also for the briefing. I know there's a number of issues that you raised that we'll consider on the briefs, but I appreciate the targeting of your arguments and your argument today. Thank you. Case just argued of Dierf versus Ryan is submitted, and we're adjourned.